Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White, in for Vicky Gonzalez today. Pride Month is coming to an end, and while it can be a time for many LGBTQ plus youth to come out, one mental health expert says it can also be a very challenging time for those struggling with the process. Gay teenagers, listen to this, 4 times more likely than their straight peers to attempt suicide. And then the pandemic has only made the situation worse. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, visits to hospital emergency rooms by LGBTQ plus teens spiked last year. And experts now say it is a full-on crisis. Ahead on Insight, we will take a closer look. Also ahead this morning, a new bill that could potentially do away with curbside recycling as we know it in California. We will hear from a senator who's proposing the bill and discuss a competing bill and then sort out all the details. But first, we're continuing our conversations in concert with Cap Radio's new podcast, After the Assault. Have you listened to that yet? It is so powerful. I highly, highly recommend it. And After the Assault listens to survivors of sexual violence and investigating the road to justice. Today, our focus is on living with the trauma and what the timeline, if any, for healing might look like. Emily Dwornkin is a clinical psychologist and assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the University of Washington School of Medicine, and she joins us now. Welcome to Insight. Nice to have you here.
Thank you so much. It's so nice to be here.
So let's start off with, what do we know about the mental health impact of sexual assault?
Well, we know that sexual assault, like many other forms of trauma, can have a wide variety of mental health effects. So when you look at people who've been assaulted, you see that 7% have an anxiety disorder, 24% have a depressive disorder, 26% have PTSD, and 13% have a substance use disorder. And relevant to what you were just mentioning about suicide, 46% of sexual assault survivors have considered suicide in their lifetime.
Wow.
And about a quarter have attempted suicide.
So nearly half. Mm-hmm. So yeah. Those percentages you just gave for the different conditions, how do those compare with somebody who hasn't been the victim of a sexual assault?
Yeah, so when you look at suicide in particular, when you think about 46% of survivors having considered suicide, that's as compared to 34% of people who have not been assaulted. 25% of people who are survivors have attempted suicide in their lifetime, and that's compared to 17% of non-survivors.
Mm-hmm. So a clear spike in, yes, in those numbers. And then how long do these symptoms tend to last after sexual assault? Are these numbers, you know, from within the first year, or is this over a lifetime afterwards?
So those particular numbers are looking at survivors as a whole, regardless of when they were assaulted, and then looking at the disorders they've had in the past year. So for many people, the trauma of sexual assault can be really long lasting and take a variety of forms.
Mm. Is there any data to show that it might peak at a given moment post-sexual assault?
Yeah, that's a good question. So when we think about post-traumatic stress disorder, which is the one we normally think about when we're considering the mental health effects of trauma, including sexual assault. So what we tend to see in survivors is a really high prevalence of sexual assault, or I'm sorry, of PTSD immediately following the assault. So 75% of survivors meet PTSD criteria at 1 month post-assault. And what you see is this period of rapid natural recovery over the first 3 months where symptoms typically get better even with no intervention. And so that prevalence of 75% drops down to 54% at 3 months post-assault. Mm-hmm. And then at that point, recovery slows down in its pace, even though it continues over time, such that when you look at survivors 12 months post-assault, 41% meet criteria for PTSD.
So one of the goals of the After the Assault podcast is to, you know, help with finding justice and finding, you know, roads to recovery. What are some of the proven tools that help with this trauma post-sexual assault?
Yeah, so there's some tools that we think about in terms of what survivors can do for themselves and what their loved ones can do to support them. And then there's also certain tools that are especially effective when you're seeking therapy. So there's specific kinds of therapies that are intended to help with post-traumatic stress disorder. And these therapies have very high success rates, such that most people that complete these therapies, which are about 12 sessions typically, no longer meet criteria for PTSD at the end. So I can speak to tools in any of those domains.
Mm-hmm. Well, Professor, I'm wondering, do you have data that shows people who go through these programs, are successful at a certain rate versus people that try to go it on their own?
Yeah, so what we normally see is that we do see this period of natural recovery where a lot of people will get better with no intervention. But once PTSD becomes chronic, so once it's been in place for months or even years, it is somewhat unlikely for it to just go away on its own, although that does tend to happen from time to time. What we see in people getting these therapies is really high rates of remission of the disorder. Mm-hmm. So these therapies do tend to work better than doing nothing, and they also tend to work better than what we would consider kind of general unstructured talk therapy. So therapies that last maybe years and don't involve specifically targeting the disorder or using a process that's proven to help with this disorder.
I imagine that there are triggering agents also that bring back the trauma to overwhelming points. What might some of those be?
Yeah, so first I want to distinguish between bringing back the trauma itself and bringing up the traumatic stress that's resulting from the trauma. So oftentimes we talk about those things in the same way, but one of the things I want to emphasize is that the traumatic event ends when the event is over, and then the traumatic stress is what lingers over time. But when a survivor is reminded of the assault, it can really feel like they're back in the situation where the event itself is happening. And that is their brain's natural alarm system kind of setting off this alarm and telling them that they're in a dangerous situation, because it has sort of encoded all these things that remind your brain of the assault with the sense of danger. I sort of think of it like when you have a smoke detector that goes off when you take a shower. Your brain sort of becomes that kind of alarm system that's over attuned to cues that might represent risk.
And what are some of the triggering agents that might make this happen? Could a conversation like the one we're having right now, could this be a triggering agent?
Yeah, so one of the things that's important to keep in mind about triggers when we're thinking about people with PTSD, triggers can be literally anything that reminds them of the assault or of the feelings associated with it. So it can include people that look a certain way. It can include being in a certain setting. It can include just thinking about what happened or talking about what happened. I've treated people for PTSD that were triggered by certain types of deodorant or certain perfumes. There is no one size fits all trigger, and it's so individual to the person and their assault experience. And without knowing the details from their perspective, it's really hard to anticipate what would be triggering.
That's interesting about the perfume or deodorant. The power of olfactory senses really can bring you back to a moment, hopefully a positive moment, but in this case, not. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and we're speaking with Emily Dworkin, a clinical psychologist in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the University of Washington School of Medicine. And this discussion is part of Insight's collaboration with CAP Radio's After the Assault podcast. So, Professor, I'm curious, people in survivors' lives, what can they do to support them? Because as we know, the numbers are really high for those who have experienced this, but there are so many others who surround these people. What's their best path in dealing with the situation?
Absolutely. So I tell supporters of survivors to be a person to whom the survivor knows they can go for compassion when they're experiencing difficult thoughts and feelings, because we know that the trauma of sexual assault is sort of like an emotional wound where it hurts to change the bandage, it hurts to clean it out, but sort of airing it out is what helps with the healing process. But it's really important that it be aired out in a safe environment, just like you wouldn't want to clean a wound with dirty water. You also don't want to air out trauma in a setting where people are going to be unsupportive to you. Mm. So the more people survivors have in their social community that they can go to for compassion and that sort of airing out process, the better. And supporters can really show that they care through supportive listening, which includes focusing on the survivor. So listening attentively, putting away your phone and other distractions, keeping the focus on what they're saying about their thoughts and emotions instead of, you know, thinking about what you're going to say next or other mm-hmm. topics. And then trying to really understand their perspective. So ask questions that help you understand what they're thinking and feeling. Repeat back in your own words what they told you and ask them if you got it right, and use what you learned to put yourself in their shoes. And then finally, and perhaps most importantly, acknowledge that their perspective is valid. So explain why you think their thoughts and emotions are understandable given their situation, even if your thoughts and emotions would be different, uh-huh. and tell them that you think what they're experiencing is difficult, painful, scary, et cetera.
And I imagine that would include not minimizing what's being said, not saying, well, that happened, but at least this didn't happen, or something along those lines.
Absolutely. Your job as a supporter is not to make the survivor feel better, which is a really tough thing to get your head around.
It is tough. Like your instincts are to do that.
Yep. And even, you know, I've been working in this field for 17 years now. And, you know, I know better, but still when somebody comes to me and they're in pain, when you love someone, all you want to do is take that pain away in the moment.
Yeah.
But your job as a supporter is to bear witness to the pain rather than to make it go away in the moment. And then that process of bearing witness and acknowledging the pain is what helps it get better over time.
Let's talk a little bit about timelines. I imagine that some people, even supporters, might say, hey, it's been this long since that happened. You should be at this point by now. But there really are no timelines, right?
There really are no timelines, and it's really individual, and it really depends on survivors' situation and the resources that they have access to. And for many survivors, the mental health effects may last months or years. But what I really want to emphasize is that the mental health effects are treatable disorders by and large. And we have really great evidence-based therapies that are really successful at resolving the disorders that result from sexual assault. And in fact, both of the evidence-based treatments for PTSD were originally developed for sexual assault survivors. And so we know that these are really kind of intended and meant to help with the trauma of sexual assault or the traumatic stress resulting from sexual assault, even though they're used now widely for a variety of different types of trauma.
Mm-hmm. We talked about the supporters that may be in your life who can help you and be a resource to talk to. But, you know, immediately following the sexual assault, or at least along the way, there are many professionals that survivors need to talk to, including the police and lawyers and therapists. How might those people do a better job in minimizing the harm?
Yeah, so I think that they can take the same skills that I just mentioned in the supportive listening arena and really focus on giving the survivor a degree of autonomy and choice where possible. So it's not always possible in systems, like the police can't always give survivors a choice in what happens next, or prosecutors can't always give survivors a choice, but at least explaining what's going on and why it's happening and when there are opportunities for choice, giving those choices to the survivor and doing their best to express compassion and listen supportively rather than expressing judgment or minimizing or trying to kind of fix the situation just in that conversation. Because of course we can't change the fact that an assault happened. We can only support the survivor after it.
Professor, you're in the academic world. Finally here in about a minute, are there opportunities for survivors to contribute to research that could help other survivors?
Absolutely. So right now I'm doing a study on a new program that's intended for pairs of survivors and their supporters to train supporters in providing the kind of support that we know works. And to prepare us to do that study, we're recruiting survivors that have been assaulted in the past year to come in with their supporters via a Zoom session and just give us feedback. We pay both people $40. And people can learn more about that opportunity at takecareaftertrauma.com. Also, if people have been assaulted in the past 10 weeks, I have a clinical trial of a new app called Thrive, and survivors can learn about that at thriveappstudy.com.
And we'll pop those links into the Cap Radio Insight page. Emily Dworkin is a clinical psychologist and assistant professor in the Department of Psychology and Behavioral Sciences. That's all at the University of Washington School of Medicine. Thank you for joining us today and sharing that very valuable information.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we do have a guide for reporting a sexual assault, a whole glossary of terms and support organizations at capradio.org/after. And then you can start listening to the podcast by going to capradio.org/afterTheAssault. Up next, we speak with Democratic Senator Bob Wieckowski, who's proposing a new bill that could potentially do away with curbside recycling as we know it in California, and also the environmental group opposing it, California's Against Waste, also joins us. You can join the conversation anytime. Email us, insight@capradio.org, or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. And you are listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Randall White, in today for Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You are listening live to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. In today for Vicky Gonzalez, the California Senate recently passed SB 38. It's a bill that could significantly change the way recycling works throughout the state. Right now, Californians can bring their aluminum cans, glass, plastic bottles down to a local recycling center. Each container under 24 ounces is worth a nickel, and then each one 24 ounces or more nets you a dime. That deposit is supposed to encourage you to return those used items for recycling, putting the responsibility on you, the consumer. But California has one of the lowest bottle and can redemption rates among bottle deposit states. We're not the only state that operates this way. And Senator Bob Wieckowski, a Democrat in Fremont, says the current system just isn't working, and it hasn't worked for years. You might even say decades. So he authored SB 38. And the idea behind the bill is to essentially shift the responsibility of recycling from you, the consumer, to the distributor. Senator Wieckowski joins us now. Welcome to Insight. Nice to speak with you again.
Randall, it's great to be back on your show.
Well, walk me through how your plan would work. Let's say I buy a bottle of water at the store or a big crate of them at Costco. Then what?
Okay. So what happens right now is when you buy your batch of waters at Costco, you pay the nickel and you get back in the, and under the California recycling program, you get back the value of that scrap plastic or scrap metal when you bring it back to a recycling center, if you can find one, if you can find one. And what we've seen over the last decade is these recycling centers have shrunk. And what we've also seen is the deposit that you get back, because the price of oil that goes down, that people are getting about 50%. So you pay a nickel, but you get 2.5 cents back. And all that delta that's in between the 2.5, your cap radio listeners, that goes to distributors, that goes to curbside people, that goes to plastic people. We have 17 different programs that we give away money. And all those 17 different people are all opposing the bill because they like the status quo. I mean, it's funny, or actually it's sad for cap radio listeners. You know, when they set up the program, they said, distributors, when you bring those bottles to Costco, and the Costco gives you the nickel for it. It's an accounting thing that distributors actually don't get it, but they were going to get 1.5% of for the cost of the handling that. And then somebody got a cool idea and say, let's make it 1.5%. So today, the distributors get $24 million a year just for bringing the bottles to Costco because of the accounting that they have. And I think that the consumers are getting ripped off. The consumers shouldn't pay that. We should let them set up the program and they figure out how much money you should get. It probably should be $2 million, not $24 million, something like this.
So, Senator, if we don't pay this deposit, and then I bring these bottles or cans back to the house, consume what's ever in them, what is then to encourage me to make sure that that container then makes it to a recycling center?
Well, it's the convenience of it. You know, the promise in 86 was that we were going to have all these reverse vending machines, bag drops, different grocery stores were going to take it back. So Californians want to be recyclers. You go around the world, we're always boasting about what good recyclers we are. But what we've done is, you know, the curbside folks and the trash people have said, let's make it easy for the consumer. Let's do single stream. And what's happening with single stream is the contamination rate is off the charts.
And single stream is when you dump everything into the same can.
The one, right? I mean, it's like it's America. Let's just put all our recycling together, and somehow magically it gets sorted. And the reality is that, you know, everybody cries about China, the national sword not taking our stuff. They take our stuff. They just need to have a 0.5% contamination rate, and we're sky high. We are lousy recyclers. So the idea is that you make the producers be responsible. You say, you guys sort it out, but you make all these bag drops, curbside recycling, vending machines easy for me to get my full nickel back. And all that delta in between, you work it out amongst yourselves. You, Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, you know, Anheuser-Busch, who's ever producing the beverages for a California consumer.
So under your bill, if I understand this correctly, then there's still a redemption value. It's just not being paid for by the consumer when they check out at the store. Or do I have that wrong?
No, there's the redemption value would be the full nickel. We're not valuing on what the price of scrap metal is. We're saying the producers, you guys who make the bottles through the distributors, right? They're the people that are doing the counting. You pay the consumer the full nickel, and you also recycle at 85%. You know, the law now says it's supposed to be 80. We're upping it because we want to do a better job for climate change and global warming. We want to be leaders in this area.
Yeah. And so we're going to speak with somebody in just a moment here who is opposed to your bill and supports a competing bill, AB 1454. What do you make of the opposition that you've encountered since this passed the Senate?
Well, I mean, they're well organized. I mean, but at the bottom line, they forgot the consumer. They forgot the cap radio listener. They're representing curbside, which gets a $12 million or $15 million subsidy from the program every year. They're representing the distributors who are getting $24 million. They're representing the plastic people, different people who get a subsidy from the program versus the consumer who says, make it easy for me to recycle. Make it and give me back my dime. Stop nickel and diming me for this. We've amended the recycling bill 75 times. And now they want to do it 76 or 77, right? And there are 40 other programs. You're going to hear them say that this is some radical idea that I have and that it's going to help out a foreign reverse vending machine. I got Olin in Milpitas, California, does a reverse vending machine. So I don't know what they're talking about, but there are 40 other entities, Germany, Canada, Oregon, Michigan, that have the producers, the stewardship program, do the recycling program. California is the only one that has big government handle it. And in 1986, it was a good idea. Now consumers say, figure it out, Coca-Cola, figure it out, Anheuser-Busch. And I'll just say this, Randall, Safeway, Costco, Walmart, Waste Management, they all do business in Oregon. They all do business in Canada. They're used to this system. We're so bloated here in California with all these subsidies that they don't want to change anything. And they'll masquerade like, oh, it's just a minor tinkering. There's large areas of California that have no place to bring back their cans and bottles. And that's going to change with SB 38, because we're going to say, producers, you make sure that people have a convenient place either to drop their cans or vend or have a recycling center up there. So
Your bill, Senator, is closely modeled after Oregon or Canada, Germany. Which one would it be closest to?
The elegant part about SB 38 is it lets the players design the program. We say, the distributors have to organize it, but let's be frank. The producer's going to be there. The retailer's going to be there. Anheuser-Busch, Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, Waste Management, Republic, all of them are going to be there and design the program for California, mirroring what's happening in Canada and Norway and Germany, and take the best practice. That's one of the problems that they have, is that it's designed eloquently so that they can take the best practices around the world to make California the head honcho when it comes to recycling bottles and cans.
We pulled up California's recycling page this morning during our Insight meeting, and the team, we were looking at the deposits. None of us could really, like, off the top of our head, say what we were paying for these cans and bottles. And one thing that came as a surprise was that milk and wine containers are not included in the redemption system. Do you know why that is?
That was a deal that was made in 86. I mean, this is my third time doing an extended producer responsibility. And last year, I tried to get wine and distilled spirits in. And the lobbying effort was unbelievable. I mean, it's big this year. It was bigger last year.
Yeah.
And they thought that milk is such a necessary commodity that they wanted to exempt it. Mm. I think the better practice is that you're going to see the wine. There's another bill that's going on that they want to bring reusable bottles. There's a couple of bills on reusable bottles so that the wine people will get in there, because, they're all in their cap and trade. So it takes a lot of heat to redo those bottles. And eventually, as the price of doing the emissions rises from $19 to, let's say, $41, which is the world price of polluting right now. Mm. We're way below the metric tons. That's going to galvanize them to say, we've got to do a better job.
Do you have the governor's support on this?
The recycling, the director of recycling has been agnostic. They like it. I mean, Jerry Brown tried to come bring all the parties together. We've been working on this for the 10 years that I've been in the legislature. So the governor is helpful. He's supporting from a information point of view about what, what's true and what's not true, because things get close to a vote and you hear, now understand the opposition is saying that the immigrants are going to be adversely affected by the bill. I have no idea, but I know that they said that when we did the recycling bag, saying you had to use reusable bags, all of a sudden the immigrant community was going to be hurt. So I'm still saying the same thing, consumers, consumers, consumers. I want it convenient and I want to get the full dime back.
Finally, I do want to give you the same opportunity as our next guest, and that is to comment on the opposing bill, AB 1454. What is it about that bill that you feel is not as good as your SB 38?
Well, it's I may do a fundamental change to the program. I mean, 1454 provides $25 million for more Band-Aids over the system. I'm the budget chair of the recycling. I'm willing and prepared to lobby for more money in the interim so that curbside and recycling centers and weight stations and all the parties that are there build up so that we can switch it to an extended producer responsibility. It's just another Band-Aid. I don't want a Band-Aid. I'm a fundamental reform saying we're we're failing. We're 58% of the redemption rate is what happens. So you pay a dime, and 42% of the money just goes, it either goes to the landfill or gets destroyed. Mm. I want to get that up to 85% so that you and other listeners get their nickels and dimes back.
All right, Senator Bob Wieckowski, Democrat from Fremont, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. You are listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. If you're just joining us, we're talking about SB 38, which is a bill that would shift the responsibility of recycling from the consumer. It's a bill, though, that not everyone is on board with, including our next guest, Mark Murray. He's the executive director of Californians Against Waste. That's a nonprofit group working to reduce pollution and waste and increase recycling and protect the environment. Mark joins us now. Welcome to Insight.
Morning, Randall. Good to be here.
So I know you were on the call here during the senator's time on Insight. Was there anything in particular that stood out that you want to address off the top?
Yeah, you know, I guess I want to start off by saying that Senator Wieckowski is one of my favorite members of the legislature. We honored him as our legislator of the year 2 years ago. He's a big idea guy, and this is a big idea that he's put forward. And so I think he's very well intended, and we appreciate his enthusiasm for recycling. On this specific issue, though, I don't think he understands how the existing program works. He deals with lots of important environmental issues, and it doesn't seem that he understands that in California's existing program, consumers are currently redeeming at a higher rate than Oregon. 50 million beverage containers are returned for recycling every single day in the state of California. And 85% of those containers that are recycled are being redeemed for cash by consumers. So consumers do have the opportunity to recycle in most communities. Now, it is absolutely true that there are a number of communities in California, and including almost the entire Bay Area, that don't have sufficient community-based recycling centers. There's not enough recycling centers in the Bay Area. There's not enough recycling centers in the North Coast. And there are even areas in the Central Valley where there aren't enough recycling centers. But even without having those recycling centers, we still have a recycling rate that is better than all but two states. Oregon and Michigan have higher recycling rates, but they also have a dime refund value. We only have a nickel refund value. So I think that it's really obvious why California's rates today are not as high as they are in Oregon, and why 3 years ago, with the so-called EPR model that Oregon has, California was doing better than Oregon. It's all about a nickel versus a dime. We think we can, with a handful of tweaks, and we need the legislature and the governor to take action on this. CalRecycle doesn't have the authority to fix it on their own. But we think that this program can move from the current 70% recycling rate back to an 80 or 85% recycling rate by reinvesting in community-based recycling centers, bringing back 400 to 600 recycling centers in the state of California. And then maybe in a year or two, we're going to be ready for a dime refund value here in California.
Is that part of AB 1454, increasing it to a dime?
No, it is not. Mm-hmm. I think that the step one, I would personally love to see a dime refund value, but I don't think the legislature is ready for a dime refund value until and unless they know that consumers can get their money back. And frankly, even with SB 38, there's no guarantee that consumers are going to be able to get their money back. As the senator was describing, the details of how SB 38, how that program is going to work, are not spelled out. He's leaving that to beverage distributors. And I think, you know, he's wishfully believing that the beverage industry was going to work together in terms of coming up with a recycling plan. And I don't think there's much evidence of that happening. The beverage distributors and the beverage manufacturers are at war right now in the state of California. I'm sorry, beer distributors and beer manufacturers. So I think it's overly optimistic to think that those guys are all of a sudden going to be singing kumbaya and agreeing on a recycling program that's good for California consumers.
And beer, we should mention, beer containers are subject to the redemption value, whereas, as we mentioned before, wine and spirits are not. I want to make sure I understand something because you mentioned a couple of conflicting things. One, that California has better numbers, but then you said Oregon is beating us. If I understand the difference, it's in total volume, which California, because of its size, typically is at the top of a lot of those things. But the rate of recycling is better in Oregon. So
right.
You would
have. Yeah, but I do want to clarify on that. So in California, the state of California is responsible for determining how many containers get recycled and how many containers are sold. And it's basically a violation of law to misrepresent either of those. In Oregon, we're relying on the beverage distributors to tell us how many containers are recycled and how many containers are being sold. In California, even today, we are recycling more containers per capita than they are in Oregon. So the volume of containers per consumer that get recycled in California is higher than Oregon. Now, the distributors in Oregon are reporting a higher recycling rate. They're reporting an 80% recycling rate for 2020. The state of California is reporting a 70% beverage container recycling rate for the state of California. Those the latest California numbers. So all of this is about a 10 percentage point difference.
Do the distributors, but that's a lot when you take in the size of the state of California, 10% of all those recycled bottles and cans add up to a lot. What is there an incentive for the distributors in Oregon to improperly inflate their numbers? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah. Yes.
What's the incentive?
I'm saying, the incentive is, I think that what's happening in Oregon is somehow the state of Oregon appears to be underreporting the number of beverage containers that are being sold, which would suggest that they're not paying the refund value on all those containers.
Mark, is there a state or government that is getting it right? Canada and Germany were both mentioned. Is there a version of this recycling system that seems to work really well anywhere around the globe?
Yeah. You know, I think, I will say that I think that California is doing a great job in terms of recycling, in that everyone can play. I think it's a benefit that I can put my beverage containers in my curbside recycling program, as I did this morning. And I know that the refund value that I paid on those beverage containers is going to accrue to the program and help to offset the cost. So I think that that's a positive feature of California's program. But, you know, the Netherlands has a fantastic beverage container recycling program. They're at a 95% recycling rate. That 95% recycling rate that the beverage industry is all in on is based on the fact that you get taxed if you're at less than a 95% recycling rate. And that's kind of the problem with Senator Wycowski's SB 38. There's nothing in the bill that compels the beverage distributors to do a good job. And the cheapest recycling program for beverage distributors would be a program that doesn't work very well. Mm. If that recycling rate is at a lackluster 65% rate, as it was in Oregon just 4 years ago, it was a 63% rate in Oregon just 4 years ago with the beverage distributors running the program. And they were making a lot of money because they were keeping all of the unredeemed money. The beverage distributors keep the unredeemed money in Oregon.
As I asked the senator, Mark, do you know whether the governor is supporting AB 1454?
Governor hasn't taken a position on either bill. The governor is providing, governor's staff, Cal Recycle, is providing technical assistance to 1454, to Assemblymember Bloom, who's the author of AB 1454, as well as providing technical assistance to Senator Wycowski and SB 38. Cal Recycle is basically asking the legislature, tell us what you want. What is the program that you want us to run? We can't do anything without the legislature telling us and authorizing us to run the recycling program.
And it did. Do I understand it passed unanimously in the assembly?
1454 passed unanimously out of the assembly. It's sitting in center in the Senate EQ committee, and Senator Witkowski will have a chance to vote on it on July 7th.
All right. Mark Murray is the executive director of Californians Against Waste. Thank you so much for giving us some insight into the complicated recycling choices we have that lay ahead.
Hey, thanks for bringing attention to this issue. I really appreciate it.
You bet. All right, still ahead, a closer look at LGBTQ plus youth mental health as Pride Month comes to a close, including the rise in suicide, bullying, and issues with coming out. You can join the conversation as well, insight at capradio.org. You are listening to Insight right here, live on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, in today for Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio here. I'm your host, Randall White, in today for Vicky Gonzalez. Young people have struggled to adapt to new realities brought on by the pandemic, and that is especially true for LGBTQ plus youth. Before the pandemic, many gay teenagers may have already been grappling with difficult living situations, and they were already four times more likely than their straight peers to attempt suicide. Now, according to the CDC, visits to hospital emergency rooms by LGBTQ plus teens spiked last year, and experts now say it's a full-on crisis. Dr. Michael Ennenbach is the clinical director and associate medical director at the Child Mind Institute, which is an independent nonprofit dedicated to transforming the lives of children struggling with mental health and learning disorders. It is based in the San Francisco Bay Area. He's also the president-elect of Pride Kappa. That's a national organization of gay, lesbian, transgender, and queer child psychiatrists. Dr. Ennenbach joins us now. Welcome to Insight. Nice to have you here.
Hi, it's great to be here.
So what are some of the mental health challenges that LGBTQ plus youth face in general?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think just at baseline, thinking about youth in general and their mental health needs, and that most, that there's not enough providers to provide mental health to youth. And when we get to LGBTQ plus youth, it's even more marked. LGBTQ youth are about five times as likely to commit suicide or attempt suicide than their straight peers. And a recent report by the Trevor Project, which is a Bay Area nonprofit, showed that 80% of LGBTQ plus youth have been impacted by the pandemic and that their mental health needs have risen. And we think about why that is. And, you know, for every kid, being stuck at home with your families has been hard, not having the social link in person. I mean, it's been great that we've had the online connections, but also when you're talking about social media, you know, increasing social media use can affect mental health in negative ways. There's a lot less privacy for these kids. This is Pride Month, and you know, a lot of kids do come out during Pride Month. And so we've had two Pride Months in this pandemic that have made that a little bit more challenging. It's interesting too, there's also some research that came out that college kids who have been back at home have had to sort of repress their coming out. Like if they were able, it felt more comfortable being out in college than they mm-hmm. do in their parents' house, which makes sense too. I think, you know, there's a lot of ways families can provide support for for kids during this time. The TrevorProject.org is a great website and a great link. They have a hotline that families or kids can call if they're feeling at risk or just have questions. Our website, childmind.org, also has a lot of good resources for families.
Accessing some of these resources to help deal with the situation requires some level of being out, though, does it not? And so for those kids who haven't made it to that point yet, what are your words of advice for them?
And that's a great question. I mean, the Trevor Project hotline is an anonymous hotline that kids can call and talk about these things. You know, there's not enough mental health providers in general in this country for youth. So, but seeking out resources from the Child Mind Institute, our offices in San Mateo, we're doing in-person meetings again. And if a youth can just kind of talk to their parents about, hey, I just want to talk to someone mm-hmm. about just being vague about that and then getting them help, we are a great resource for that. Like I said, we're doing in-person and virtual meetings now. So it's getting back to normal in terms of, being able to provide more support in person, which is helpful. And families can also, call us or call a provider to talk about if they have concerns of their own, that they can talk to a therapist as well.
Doctor, what about bullying? During the pandemic, kids weren't going to school, so they might have avoided some of that in-person bullying that can happen, but I imagine it still exists on some level through social media and other outlets.
Yeah, I mean, bullying has really, it's shifted a little bit. I mean, there's a lot of in-person bullying still, but the online bullying through social media is just at a different level in general, and especially now when kids are more on their computer, looking more at social media, that can really be a major problem. But you're right. We're getting back to in-person, it seems like most kids are going back to school full time in the fall. So this is an issue that's going to come up again in the fall. But it happens whether you're in person or not.
Mm-hmm. So we're winding down with Pride Month. So over the last several weeks, gay youth, LGBTQ plus youth may have seen opportunities to come out. Can that actually cause a level of stress because they feel like now's my time, I have to do it?
Certainly that if they feel like they wanted to come out during Pride Month and they haven't done it yet and it's winding down, they could put some pressure on themselves for that. But, it's important to know that, no matter when a kid decides to come out, that there's supports there for them, not just during Pride Month. It's a lot more, talked about and in the news and everything for Pride Month, but we're here to talk at any time. So anytime a kid wants to discuss that process, talk with someone, there's someone to talk to about it.
Yeah. And speaking of the news, Las Vegas Raiders NFL football player Carl Nassib came out. This is huge. Let's take a listen to a clip from his coming out.
What's up, people? I'm Carl Nassib. I'm at my house here in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Just want to take a quick moment to say that I'm gay. I've been meaning to do this for a while now, but I finally feel comfortable enough to get it off my chest. I really have the best life. I got the best family, friends, and job a guy could ask for. I'm a pretty private person, so I hope you guys know that I'm really not doing this for attention. I just think that representation and visibility are so important.
Mm. So what were the conversations you had after hearing that?
I mean, it's great. It's one of those things, and he actually, mentioned this at the end of his talk about, hopefully one day we'll get to a point where this isn't news. But it is a really big deal. It's a huge step. And he did it in a very good way. It just sort of saying, hey, just want to let you know this. He did it during Pride Month. And it's a big deal. We've never had this before. So it's great for kids who are, in the process of coming out or identify as gay and are athletes. And obviously we know there's a lot more athletes out there in professional sports that probably identify as gay.
When I was a kid, there would have, Pride in downtown Sacramento was sponsored by the Sacramento Kings in part. The Sacramento Republic FC soccer team had Pride Night on Saturday. We have, Carl Nassib coming out, countless characters on television that are positive gay characters. That just wasn't a thing when I was a kid.
No, me neither. I mean, this is happening. There's been a lot of development in a pretty short period of time, really. in terms of this. And, you know, in the NCAA has always been an ally. You know, they moved one of their basketball tournaments from North Carolina during the transgender bathroom bill debate. So I think there's always been this level of support that we know is there, but to have someone on the inside who's actually, you know, an active player come out in the way he did and have the NFL support him the way they have is huge.
Finally, Dr. Pretty quickly here, LGBTQ plus teens, bullying and suicide. What are some of the warning signs parents and friends, loved ones can look out for?
Yeah, so I think it's important to, you know, just be aware of your child's mood. If they seem more withdrawn or down, tearful or even irritable, that can signal some depression, which could stem from bullying. Reduced appetite, changes in their sleep, things like that can also result from bullying or depression. And like I said, you know, I think if you notice any of this, it's nice to be able to sit down with your kid and just say, hey, I'm noticing this, how things going okay, and not be very pointed about it, but just kind of open the door for them to talk and, you know, and say, you know, would you want to talk to someone? You know, that's not me. And, you know, if that's the case, you know, again, there's resources out there. And like we have financial aid at Child Mind Institute. We have availabilities very quickly. That's what they should do.
Dr. Michael Enenbach, Clinical Director and Associate Medical Director at the Child Mind Institute in the San Francisco Bay Area. Also, congratulations, President-elect of Pride Kappa. Really appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much.
And that is Insight for today. Learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or of course, wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you to Kyle McKinnon, who put this show together, Cynthia Lopez, and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. I am Randall White, in for Vicky Gonzalez. Have a great day.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.